I welcome all of you, and I'm really grateful all of you are here. It's obviously somewhat of an experiment to see how this goes. I am going to try and run this similar to the format that we've been running all along in the regular meditation hall with small breakout groups and the rest of it, because those have seemed to be very useful to everybody. So we'll see what happens. It depends on the size of people, how we'll break those apart. When we get there. Obviously, this is a different format. I'm certainly, as other people are mentioning, I'm really grateful for my practice in this time. It's been extremely useful to me, both from a practical standpoint of having done silent retreats and that I'm used to cutting myself off at times from the rest of culture and stepping back away. And this is doing that. And at the same time, it's a good place to practice time and place to practice metta, loving kindness, and all of the rest of it. So it's just been a good time. So I hope that we move out of it in reasonable period, but obviously we want to take care of everybody. So we'll stay in this format for at least this period and probably the next one as well, and then see how it goes from there. I want to acknowledge the commitment that all of you are making by being here. I think it's important that you keep up your practice for very, very similar reasons. So what I think we'll do now is give other people some time to come in, because I don't know if people are having trouble or they just got distracted by the day, whatever. So let's go ahead and do a 10-minute or 15-minute set. That'll allow us to settle into the day. And then when we come back, I'll do my part of the talk. So I'll turn it over to Susan at this point so she can both introduce herself, since I don't have all the things. I don't have an in-depth knowledge of all that she has been doing. And I think it's all good. Also, she's a good person to lead this initial set. So, Susan, you've unmuted yourself, so why don't you just go ahead and take over, lead us in the set, and I'll mute myself until you're done.
Okay. Well, I'm very happy to have this opportunity to connect with people. Been spending a lot of time alone. Some of you I already know, some of you know me, but just briefly, I'm one of the founders of the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City way back in 2001, 2002, and I did teach there from time to time over the years, and then I got very involved in training and working as a hospital chaplain, and I did that for 2 years, actually, in Oxnard as a palliative care chaplain, and came back and in the Bay Area and worked as the spiritual care manager at San Francisco General. And I'm retired now from full-time chaplaincy. I live in Santa Cruz now, and I love it here, and I've been looking for something part-time, but haven't found anything yet. So that's me. And so for this guided sit, let's take a few deep breaths now and just settle into the body, settle into your chair or your feet on the floor. Just as you exhale, just feel the solidity of your body on the seat or standing. And feel the breath, feel the breath in and out. Where is it in your body that you feel it? And how is it in this moment? Just take a few moments to check in with the breath and just notice how it is. However it is fine. So I'd like to begin also with just having a sense of goodwill towards yourself. These are difficult times, so just take a moment to wish yourself well. And then send that goodwill out to those, your loved ones, those you know. Wish for them to be well and at peace. And then take that sense of goodwill and just radiate it out to all beings everywhere. May all beings be well and safe. So now I'd like to just move the awareness all through the body, starting with the forehead. Just relaxing any furrows in the forehead, and relaxing the eyes and the eye sockets. Relax the chest, the shoulders. And the belly, if there's any holding in the belly, see if you can just let that go. And now with a relaxed, alert attention, observe the flow of your experience here and now. Whatever that is, whatever arises, the beauty of this practice is it holds whatever arises. The pleasant or the unpleasant or neither. Just are aware. And notice if there are any feelings of resistance in the body or a holding to any particular thing that arises, a particular experience. See if you can just relax and let that go. The beauty of our practice is it's no need to judge or reject anything. We just bring our mindful awareness to what is arising in this moment. One moment. Flowing into the next. One experience arising, passing away. Another arises to take its place. Always staying connected with the breath. The body. Thoughts come and go. No need to get involved, just recognizing, thinking. Thoughts can flow, feelings, sensations, flowing. So now just take a moment to check in again with your breath, with the body. And just notice any changes from when we first began to sit. Any changes in the body, in the breath, in the letting go. So to end the sitting, I will just say, may our practice bring us some sense of ease in the midst of these difficult times. And that will end our meditation. I looked high and low for my bell, my meditation bell, and I could not locate it. So you can now open your eyes, and here we are. Thank you for your companionship during this sitting. It was lovely. Turn it over to Jim now. Or shall I start my talk? I'm not exactly sure since the timing is a little bit different, so.
No, I'll go ahead and I'll
you
do.
You have your talk. You're going to be doing.
I'll be doing the first thing. Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Because I didn't take very good. Okay, so just a little bit on mechanics. All of you have control of your microphones, so you can turn them on and off as is appropriate. We certainly want you to be involved and talk with us and everything. I also recognize that in this type of meeting, sometimes you can have a lot of background noise in the house or around you. And if too many people are doing that, it gets a little distracting. So it's a good practice to leave the microphone off until you want to talk. The other thing is we'll be breaking out and at the end of my talk, we'll go ahead and break out into a couple of breakout groups. That looks like with people we have here, to probably two groups of four. When you get over into those groups, I won't be able to see what you're doing, but I can come in if you want to. There is a help button at the bottom of your screen when you're in those groups. So if you need help, you can go ahead and let us know and we'll show up to do what we need to do. Otherwise, I can interact with you to some extent. I can send messages and announcements. So if we need to do some timing and stuff, or when we need to bring you back to the group as a whole, the system will let you know that that's gonna happen. So anyway, that's pretty much it. You do have a chat function, but with this smaller group, I don't think you'll need it. If you need to interrupt, or if you need to say something, or you have a question or whatever, I think we're a small enough group that we can probably work with that fairly easily. So any questions on any of that? Okay, then what I want to do is I kind of want to pick up a little bit from where I was last month. I think, I'm not sure that all of you were here last month, but I know a number of you were. Last month, we were starting into the mental development factors. I pointed out that the Eightfold Path can ultimately be split up into three sections, one being an orientation section with right view and right intention, the next being a ethics and setting the conditions for your life for practice, which would be right action, right speech, and right livelihood. That gives you the environment in which to do it. And finally, this last section of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration is really kind of the going towards the how-to. It's showing you the things that you can and need to do to transform into a state of liberation, to awaken the mind. And last month when I did that, I took it kind of from a more of a global perspective rather than drilling down into right effort, although we did eventually get there. And part of the reason I did that is although we separate these three factors, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, for the purpose of analyzing them and taking them apart, it's really, really hard to practice and take them apart. Each one is inherently supports the other. So in the case of right mindfulness, for example, if you don't have the sufficient concentration to bring yourself into the present moment, it's very hard to establish mindfulness. If you don't have some capacity for effort so that once you come into the present moment, you can begin to drill into what is happening in that moment, see it, try to understand it, you really have trouble establishing anything. So these three factors, even though they're separated for the purpose of analysis, they're hard to separate for the purpose of practice. And that's what we're trying to do here. It's sort of seems like a chicken and the egg problem, but I think we'll find out it's not that much. So last week, in order to drill down from this higher level, I took it from the orientation of the skandhas, and I pointed out that in the Buddhist teachings, these tend to have been, the Buddha separates them into the five heaps, with rupa being form and material world, Samna being perception, Vedana, feeling tone, mental formations of Sankara, and then consciousness in the Jnana. Last week, I kind of only took it through metal formations, because what I was trying to point out is the mechanism by which we create the world in which we live. I think one of the examples I had used was that of perception, say of a bright light coming in through the eye, giving rise to the perception of that light as a mental object, our reaction to it, too bright maybe, uncomfortable, dukkha, and then that getting mixed in with all the rest of the thing, mental objects that are going on in our brain, all the other sensations, all the other memories, all the other associations that are going on, and then how we pick and choose and decide what we're going to look at, what we're not going to look at, what we're going to ignore, what we're going to embrace. And then we use that to construct our reality, the world in which we live. So we're kind of living in that world, and it is tied to the real world, but it is not the real world. And that was kind of the basis where we took off with Right Effort, and the fact that Right Effort is built around this idea of encouraging positive mental states, discouraging and eliminating the unwholesome mental states. Because what allows us to do that to some extent is this fact that rather than working in an external world over which we have limited control, we're really working in this mental formations, these sankharas, and building our world from that. So we have the control to do that. We have the ability to decide which what we're paying attention to, what we're not paying attention to, what we allow into our mental states, what we don't allow into mental states. And in doing that, we're not just transforming how we feel about the world, we are actually changing how the world manifests for us and how it manifests for the people around us, because of the fact that that is where we build that world. That's where we have that type of thing taking place. Now I want to try and move on a bit into mindfulness. And in order to get into mindfulness, I have to draw in that the last of the heaps, and that is vijnana. Vijnana is one term that you encounter in a number of different places in the suttas. Citta is another common term for what's going on here, and mana is often also used. And this is the state of consciousness. In the description I've given so far, it's been there, but it's been easy to ignore it. When I talk about we build our world and we live inside of that world, that we is something we can pass over very easily, without a whole lot of work. But that we, that I, that world, that consciousness that's living in that world is what vijnana is referring to. So then these two aspects, the aspect of the mental formations and the aspect of the consciousness that sees those mental formations, are really the global area in which we exist, in which we work. And concentration and mindfulness is dependent upon, obviously, this ability to know. Ajahn Khan has said that when he was younger, he never really understood that consciousness and the objects that existed were separate quantities of the mind. And that because of getting these two confused in a tangled web, he never was able to find much peace. And it was actually when he met Ajahn Mun, who eventually was the monk that he would go on for the most of his rest of his life to think of and name as his primary teacher, that he was able to really come to the realization that our world is really made up of this consciousness, this knower, and the set of objects that are known. And that this is where we exist, where we work, where we practice, where we do things. And this is, as meditation moves on, and as we try and go into the area of insight, this is kind of where we're trying to go. So this was a key insight for him, and actually became a major theme and major part of his teachings from that point on. And he's one of the teachers who's been very important to our practice, our lineage. As he worked with it, he eventually began to describe this process as if it were a mirror and objects in a mirror, because he came to realize that this consciousness that is reflecting all of this is more passive, or more, it's more static than it is active. The most of the activity that's taking place in your world, the most of the arising, most of what happens in the objects, and the consciousness mostly reflects it. This is a theme that is common through a number of different traditions. If you go into the Zen traditions, for example, you'll find that this analogy of the mind and the contents of the mind being a mirror and the objects in the mirror is an extremely common one there. And in the Tibetan practices of Dzogchen, it's also used as one of the very common metaphors for what is going on. Dzogchen being one of the highest vehicles in Tibetan practice for the realization of the nature of reality and liberation. I'm kind of pointing this out here because I think this is something you may want to bookmark. It's such a large area that I can't go too far down too many paths here. But if you continue to practice, you will eventually want to come back to this, because understanding the nature of the relationship between this consciousness and the objects of consciousness and what they are and how they work is one of the primary points that's available through meditation as you go forward. Part of the reason for that is as you get into a deeper and you start tying in other of the Buddhist teachings, in particular the teachings on the characteristics of reality, one of those characteristics is that there is no self. And that in fact, stream entry, which is one of the milestones, if you will, on the way to liberation, is the explicit realization and deeply realizing and eliminating that view of a separate existing self. And so you get into this situation in which you have to realize that the consciousness we're talking about here is not yourself. And that makes the contemplation and working with it as you go deeper into it interesting, because obviously you have the sensation of I, and this I is absolutely necessary to your experience of the world, but this I is not yourself. So that's why I say it's a deep and important place to spend some time. It's a deep and important place to get some insight, but not something I can go through, take you too far into today. And part of the reason for that is I want to come back to mindfulness, which is the topic I'm supposed to be talking about anyway. Mindfulness, sati, really can be understood as that which allows awareness of the range of dharmas. And dharmas here, is a small d dharma. It's all of these things, it's all these metal objects that are arising, it's everything that's happening that in as objects of consciousness. And what sati does is it allows us to enter into the present moment. It allows us to see what's arising It allows us to understand its full range. It allows us to put the various values onto it, relative values onto it. So it's our way of escaping from delusions, escaping from ignorance, and really knowing what's taking place. And so that's one of the reasons that it's a predecessor to insight in this area. In the Saketa Sutta, the Buddha actually goes fairly deeply into things like sati. And it's important to realize that when he does that, he points out that the sati, mindfulness, is not a single thing. It's not one thing. It's actually two things. And the two things that he sets it out to be is, first of all, it's a faculty in Pali and Indriya. It's a faculty is very much what we're used to when we talk about our sensory faculties. You know, our seeing, our hearing, our sense of taste, our sense of touch. These are all our sensory faculties. And what he's saying when he labels it as a faculty is that this is also just like those things. It's something we're born with. It's a quality that's inherent in our consciousness from the very beginning. Something that we don't have to learn to do. We have a certain capacity for mindfulness. We have a certain capacity to see what's happening in the present moment. And if we didn't, if we had to bootstrap that, we would never make it. In addition to that, though, he points out that sati is also what he calls a bala, or a power. And powers also have an analogy in our own consciousness and what we're used to. We talk about, for example, the power of reason. We talk about the power of observation. The difference between, in this case then, between the faculty which we're born with and the power is the power of reason. We start with it. It's basically based on what capacity, what faculty we have for reason. But then as we grow older, we become educated, we gain experience, we do things like that, we're able to modify and change it and grow it and make it more skillful and more useful. And so sati as a power is something that we can change. And so it's this aspect of sati as a power rather than sati as a faculty that meditation allows us to do. And in fact, he names that there are five of these things that are very important, that are both faculties and powers. And they are faith. We all have a capacity for faith, but we also have capacity to change it over time. Effort, which is the same as right effort that we started working with last week. Mindfulness, sati, which is what we're talking about now. Concentration, which is what Leslie's going to talk about next week. It's also both a faculty and a power. And then wisdom. And that's the other one. And it's those five that are considered to be the divine or spiritual faculties of the human mind. And it's those that we are working with when we're in practice of meditation and in the practice of development. It's also, as I said, there's not a chicken or egg problem, because it's the fact that we have both faculties and powers that allows us even to start this process. So, in the effort to strengthen mindfulness, coming back to mindfulness again, we have to make a clear distinction between the mind that knows and mind those mind objects that are the subject of what consciousness knows. in things like the Satipatthana Sutta or the Visuddhimagga as introductions to this process, normally they begin in the area of mindfulness of the body. And the reason for that is sati is a knowing that takes place in the present moment. And your body is also something that takes place in the present moment. Things like, say, chemistry or metaphysics or what you had for lunch, are going to have for lunch later today, are not in the present moment. The thought about them, the thinking about them may be in the present, but they're not. So they're not targets of sati. But when I breathe, it is in this present moment. I have the sensation of the breath coming in. I have the sensation of the breath turning around. I have the sensation of all of that. And that really only can take place in the present moment. So it becomes a very good target for developing this power of sati. But it also is useful because if you pay close attention to what's happening while you're in that process of breathing, and you step back from it. And this is sort of the stepping back that I've been trying to ask a lot of you to do in a number of situations, the small groups and other places. If you can step back from the immediate sensation of what's going on and see what's happening in you, see what is taking place, you also have the chance of starting to become aware of the knower, of the conscious state that is taking all of this in. It happens a lot when the breath is turning around, because when the sensation stops, the awareness is still there. When the sensation of the breathing coming in and going out stops, the spaciousness is still there. And you can be present with that spaciousness. And what you'll find, if you're present with this spaciousness, since everything is stopped, it's still. And consciousness is still. Consciousness does not move. Things move inside of consciousness, but consciousness itself does not move. Although we traditionally do work with breathing, the same process can be extended to the practice of walking meditation. Walking meditation is another good place in which sati, both sati and the insight into the nature of the skandhas becomes possible. Because when we're just standing there, or when we're starting to walk, or we're starting to do those things, we have access to all of those sensations. We have access to the sensation at the bottom of our foot, the movement of our muscles, all of that type of thing, the feeling of the air, all of this type of, this contact with what's happening in the body right now is intimately available to all of us at all the time. At the same time, when you stop, when you turn around, when you move, what you'll find is that the spaciousness around that walking is still there, particularly if you're not trying to walk somewhere. If you're not trying to walk somewhere, which you're generally not in walking meditation, you're just moving back and forth, you have no goal. When those processes stop, everything does not stop. Your awareness is still there. Your feeling for what's happening is still there. And that's a place then that allows you to begin to develop insight into how this process is taking place. So these beginning process, and I'm going to go through them because I think most of you have had some meditation with meditation on the breath, meditation on walking and stuff. I'm pretty sure that most of you know how to do that and can do that. But what I'm trying to suggest is that to develop sati, to strengthen those processes, and also to move it into more into the insight realm of that, that it is possible to do it with these practices that you have been doing by taking note both of what's happening in the present moment and note of what is arising with you inside of you and in your awareness in that moment. And again, that's an idea that I've been pushing or trying to help you discover from day one of the Eightfold Path, because it is really critical to coming to terms with the Eightfold Path and learning to use it to your advantage. So anyway, that's I think where I'm gonna leave it for right now. What I would like to do is, I think we have enough people here to do two groups of four. And then, so what I'm going to do is, well, I'll go ahead and set that up in a minute to go ahead and do that. I'm not sure the best format. It may well, I think maybe we'll do the popcorn style that we've used before. And just a reminder on how that works. I'm going to give you a couple of questions to think about, to work with. When you go into your group, you can go ahead and choose who's going to go first. There'll probably be something on the screen similar to what we have here, so you may want to use the images up there to help you orient. So one person will just come up with an idea or a comment and put it into the common pool, goes to the next person, they do the same and so forth. And I'll let you do that for probably about 10 minutes. And then I will, I can send you a message through Zoom. I'll let you know that we'll switch over to the second part, in which you can go ahead and crosstalk, discuss it, that type of thing. And then we'll, after a few minutes, 10 minutes there or so, we'll go ahead and bring you back, and we'll go ahead and see how it feels and come back into it as for the group as a whole. See if I can do chat. Yeah, see what I got here. I think I can send this. I'm gonna try and put my questions into the chat window. I think it should come out to everybody if I do that. That way you'll have them. May not let me copy them, so I may have to type them in here.
People will need to click on chat to open that column.
Oh, okay. Did everyone get that? Did you?
Mm-hmm. I got it.
Okay, so those are my questions that I would like you to work with. How would having more bodily awareness support my practice in daily life? And what can I do to support that greater awareness? So those are the two that I'll go ahead and give you to work with. This chat window will probably can probably stay up if you want when you're in the other area, so you can get to it. So what I'm going to do here is give you a couple of minutes just to think about this, while I go here and see if I can get the breakout room set up for all of you. Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and move you into your groups, and Leslie and Susan and I'll stay here. And then in about 10 minutes, I'll send a message to let you know you can switch to open discussion. And keep an eye, if any of you have a timer, keep an eye on it in case I have any problems doing that. So anyway, here we go. Okay, so how was that experience? How did the break? I haven't done the breakout groups before. Did it work for you? All of that type of thing. I'm like to learn. So, anybody who wants to can unmute their microphone and talk. There's no problem. because this is, and we'll do this for a couple minutes and then we'll take a break and so we can go do whatever we need to do ourselves. And then when we come back, Susan can give her talk. So how did it go? Anybody?
It was good. It worked better than I thought it would.
You know, go ahead.
I found it really easy. And there was one person in the group that I recognized from, you know, a physical breakout room before. So I was like, okay, here we are. It's just a little different. And it was very smooth. And our time just kind of flowed and we shared and we built on some things. And I've got some new, couple new tips. And I heard someone have an insight. So for 10 minutes, I thought it was very fruitful.
Good. You have any insights to give to me from it? From the content of it?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things in general is we realize the mindfulness bell, anything to help us train to come back and using our breath and cultivating that as a way of strengthening presence.
Mm-hmm.
So having you know, a training device where we tap into our breath and being present and being present and being present, checking in with ourselves.
Yeah.
Good. Anybody else have comments they'd like to add?
I'll add in from our group.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the logistics worked really well on that breakout, and it was really nice to see everybody's names. That's not something we see when we're sitting in the group, and it takes me, I'm not so great with names. Mm-hmm. So I really love having the names with the faces. So that's just on logistics. In terms of what we were discussing, I'll just say I wouldn't necessarily say an insight for me, but a really cool idea is when we talk about bodily awareness, I think about the negative body awareness as the thing to trigger mindfulness, like my own agitation or a tightness. And one of the members of the group talked about a feeling of compassion and loving and so on as the bodily awareness. And that's very exciting to me as a new thing to try to pay attention to.
Good. Yes.
And thank you to my group for that.
Yeah.
Yes, I would just say this practice is wonderful. It's such a deep way of caring for our bodies. It's very nourishing.
You
first unmute. I was just going to add that I've been using the practice of what Rick Hansen calls taking in the good, given the stressors and so on. When I notice something positive in a sensory and embodied way, I stop and take a little bit longer to really let it soak in. Like in our small group, Susan, when you were talking about your experience, there was something in the genuineness of what I saw in your face. And I just let myself really soak in where it went to my heart and feel it in the body, not just label it. And, you know, all that good, what Rick Hansen calls neurodharma, it really rewires the brain to spend a little more time taking in the good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for that reminder. I mean, I think about that a lot, and I practice it without knowing it now. But to label it and consciously, yes, especially these days, yeah. For sure. I think that practice, actually, that Rick Hansen, when I learned that a while ago, that really helped me get that sense, build that sense of compassion, what it feels like, you know, that heart opening experience. Strengthen that muscle.
And in terms of overall practice of bodily awareness, it doesn't have to be as big as a feeling of compassion. It can be the taste of a cup of tea. It can be my neighbor delivering the groceries this morning and looking in the bag and she got just what I wanted. You know, just thinking about what I'll cook with that and feeling it in my heart. So it can be a whole range of bodily awarenesses of something positive.
But is there any danger sometimes, I wonder, like when you lead with your heart, you know, and you put yourself out there and you're open and you're allowing all this goodness permeate. I mean, when it's the other way, when you're looking on the dark side of things, you know when to shut down, you know how that feels like, something this way coming, you know. But it just seems like it, so like if you just flip the switch and say, you know, I'm not gonna be like that anymore. I'm gonna understand that with that darkness, there is the light, or with that light, you know, you can just stand in that light and be open to it. But it's kind of scary sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. And that's with time, you know, I think this practice really strengthens this inner refuge that we cultivate. And so with time, we don't need to feel quite so like we have to defend ourselves or not quite so scary. We have this steadiness and this strength in our hearts that comes with our practice.
Any other comments?
I just have a comment about the process versus being in person in a small group like this. Mm-hmm. Is that focus on, you know, what do you notice when someone's speaking? It's a lot easier to do in person. When someone is speaking and you're listening with your body, you know how you describe it, mm-hmm. Jim, and you encourage us to do. It was different. I couldn't quite get that through the breakout rooms as readily. Maybe it's because I wasn't reminded to do it, but there's that quality of not being in the room in the room with somebody. It's harder to read just to you know, the dynamic. It's, I don't know the words to put on it, but
I would agree. You know what I mean? I find it easier to read people's body language and their emotional state and many other things. Partially, I think, is because in this format, when I'm looking at most of the people on the screen here, what I'm seeing is their head. And a lot of the information I pick up from about people and everything else is not in their head. It's in the rest of their body. So, you know, I'm sure that there's a number of reasons for it, but you're right. It is less personal. Less information comes across to me about the person.
Right. So then I can't pick it up so I can feel it in my body. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's, yeah. That was interesting to note. I just didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an amazing tool, but it doesn't really substitute for, you know, being together, physically together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is all we have.
I know.
I'm grateful for it.
I'm realizing I miss that quality. You know, it can be nerve-wracking too, right? Just as a human animal. But I think I'm really starting to miss that.
But I would say that maybe intriguing and is kind of an insight from what you're saying, dear, is I hope to go back to being more aware, more mindful of those signals when that shifts. As Jim is saying, that I'm taking in the whole body of someone, that it's important to me that I can reach out and put my hand on someone when they've said something where that might be appropriate. That I may be hearing some subtleties in their tone of voice that don't come across quite as well with this audio. I mean, we really are critters. Heck, maybe I'm smelling things. Who knows? Dogs and cats sure do about our moods. And I can't tell you how, in that sense of embodied awareness, I look forward to the first real hug.
Yeah,
like we have a ways to go. That.
Absolutely.
Sadly.
So sadly. I will take Zoom ones for now.
Right. Oh, me too.
And I'm now far more aware of the beauty that kind of embodied connection.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and take a short break here so people can get up and get coffee or do whatever they need or want to do and come back. So maybe about 5 minutes, 2 or 3 o'clock, whatever, we'll come back and turn it over to Susan for her to give us some more information. Sound good? I'll leave it up and running, so anybody who wants to be here and talk can do that as well. I don't want to cut that off.
5 minutes, is that what you said?
5 minutes to three.
Okay.
I think that's
that's
a little over 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Mm-hmm. See you soon.
Okay. Okay, well, I suppose the rest of the people will filter in as we get going here. So, Susan, I'll turn it over to you to do the second part of the program.
Very good. Thank you, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are on the path of the noble ones. O nobly born, as many of the suttas begin. So I hope that you have a sense of your own nobility through this practice. And I just wanted to take a few minutes just to acknowledge our situation, acknowledge our human condition, the difficulties and the challenges that we're all facing. You know, fear, grief, loss, uncertainty, anger. Human suffering abounds. And as we talked about before, we are daily being made aware of our vulnerability as human beings, our mortality. So how do we hold all of this, and how do we respond? And as I mentioned before, we are fortunate, so fortunate, to be practitioners of wise mindfulness and to have a way of being with, of being in relationship to what's happening in the world around us. I just wanted to read a short quote from the Dalai Lama. When your mind is trained in self-discipline, even if you are surrounded by hostile forces, your peace of mind will hardly be disturbed. On the other hand, your mental peace and calm can easily be disrupted by your own negative thoughts and emotions. The inner enemy will always remain the enemy. So this practice that we do is it's what's the weather like inside? This inner refuge as I mentioned before, that we're cultivating through our practice of the four foundations of mindfulness. This inner refuge, which is truly a fruit of our practice, it doesn't ask us to push away the difficult feelings and that the difficult emotions that arise, the fear and the grief and so on. Our practice, our training, that's what we've been doing all this time, training our minds. And this can lead us to some freedom from suffering, a way to be in relationship to these painful events, painful emotions without being swept away, without being swept away by them. And of course, as practitioners, we're always aware of, as human beings, we experience pain. We do, we experience pain. But then there's the suffering, and the suffering is what we really add to the painful situation. And this is where mindfulness comes in, where mindfulness can support us. And we can be aware of what is it that we're adding to the pain? Is there something that's optional? You know, my resistance, my anger, my wishing things were other than what they are so badly. This is what we're adding. So can we just use our practice to be with the pain? And, you know, I love the story the Buddha told, the story of the quail. The quail who lived in a field of dirt, clumps of dirt all turned up. And her feathers, of course, are the same color. And so as long as she remains in this field, her proper range, so to speak, she's safe. She's safe from predators, including the hawk. And this quail lived quite happily there. She took dust baths, she bathed in the sun, sat in the sun. She was very happy. But one day, she noticed something in the meadow across the way, in the green meadow across the way, something that looked like it might be good to eat. She wasn't sure. So she got up, she dusted off her feathers, and she wandered into the meadow, and sure enough, the hawk was circling over and spotted her and swept down and captured her. And the quail lamented this bad luck, and she told the hawk that if I'd stayed in that field of turned up dirt, you never would have found me, you never would have. Never. The hawk, being a very proud bird, disagreed. And he wanted to make his point, so he picked her up in his talons again. He took her back to the field, dropped her down, swooped back up, and the quail concealed herself behind a large clump of earth. And sure enough, the hawk couldn't see her. Couldn't see her. And she was safe and she was protected. So the moral of the story is that when we wander into what isn't our proper range, then we are opening ourselves to suffering. The Buddha said, in one who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others, Mara gains an opening, Mara gains a foothold. Mara, of course, the personification in Buddhist lore of our unskillful qualities. So I love this story. It really points to the protection that we are establishing for ourselves when we develop and abide within our inner domain, and this inner domain, this field of awareness consisting of these four foundations of mindfulness, as well as those qualities that Jim mentioned, of the five faculties, the faith and the wisdom. So it's true, we often have no control over what's happening outside of ourselves, but through this practice, through the four foundations of mindfulness, we do gain control over our relationship to what's happening. We can tame our minds, and so they don't lead us astray. We can cultivate a way of living in the world that brings about this inner refuge that I mentioned before, this inner state of freedom that's unshakable by external events. But when we allow our minds to go out of our control, when we allow wantings and fears and demands to again take us out of ourselves, when we live without mindfulness, we give up that protection. We give up our path to freedom from suffering. And I just want to say again that this practice, our practice, doesn't ask us to push away or disregard the painful thoughts, the painful feelings. We practice with them. That's the beauty of this. The Buddha gave us the tools to be in relationship to the difficult emotions. And I frequently like to use, probably some of you are familiar with the RAIN acronym, RAIN. This is like a familiar, solid tool that we can use. R being, we recognize what's happening. We acknowledge what's happening. We label it. Oh, this is that wishing things were other than what they are. And the A is for accepting that. Okay, this is what is going on right now for me. This is what has arisen. The I, we investigate it. We feel, we look for where we feel it in our bodies. We look for the thoughts that triggered it or the thoughts that are around it. We question those thoughts. Is this really true? Or can I feel this in my heart? Can I breathe into my chest and get some relief? And then, of course, the N is for non-clinging, for letting, once we've acknowledged and done our investigating, can we just let it go? So I love that RAIN acronym. And of course, as we spoke about before, as Jim was talking about the importance of the body, the Buddha said mindfulness of the body and the breath is really the only practice that we need to support us on this path to freedom from suffering. It brings us into the here and now, where we have the tools for finding ways to acknowledge what's happening, to accept it, to relax the body, and to see, once we are able to calm the body, calm the breath, we begin to actually be able to see things with some more clarity, with some wisdom. We can respond to what's happening rather than react. We can notice how caught up we are in thoughts and worries about the future, or our thoughts and regrets about the past. And we can see they're just thoughts. They're just thoughts. We don't have to get caught up in them. We don't have to believe in them. Just come back. Come back to here and now with this body, with this breath. This body rooted, we can feel it in our sittings, or if we are standing, doing standing meditation or walking meditation, we feel that body rooted to the earth. And then we can feel like a great tree bending and bowing when the great winds blow, but not breaking. You know, and sometimes as we are being with what arises, especially during a time like this, the energy that comes with the fear and the anxiety, the worry and the anger is so great that it's really good to get up off the cushion and maybe do a fast walking meditation. Go outside, take a walk, take a hike. We can dance. We can cry. When that energy comes, we have ways that we can work with that. We're mindful of it. And we can find what works for us in terms of dissipating some of that energy that's so powerful. So this situation that we find ourselves in now, difficult, painful, I wonder sometimes for myself, can I look at this can I sometimes look at this as an opportunity? The benefits, here we are, we're forced to be in seclusion. You know, it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult. But when we think about it as Buddhist practitioners, isn't this the practice that the Buddha laid out for us? He gifted it to us, and it's born out of his seclusion. And we now have many moments now to be with ourselves, to look deeply inside. I mean, this is the meaning of Vipassana, this practice that we do, looking deeply inside. Can we take some time, maybe half a day or a whole day, and make it a retreat, a home retreat? Of course, I don't know if you're sequestered with other family members, particularly children, you have another kind of practice altogether, don't you? You probably are wishing for some seclusion. Your practice, I would imagine, is all around patience, wise speech, and so on. So I have this, a passage from a talk that Jack Kornfield gave that I'd like to share with you. He said, we have a choice. Epidemics like earthquakes, tornadoes, and floods are part of the cycle of life on planet Earth. How will we respond? With greed, with hatred, fear, and ignorance? We know this only brings more suffering. Or will we respond with generosity, clarity, steadiness, love? This is the time for love. the time for bodhisattvas. In Buddhist teachings, the bodhisattva is someone who vows to alleviate suffering and brings blessings in every circumstance. A bodhisattva chooses to live with dignity and courage and radiates compassion for all, no matter where they find themselves. So, O nobly born, O bodhisattvas. That's us. That's the path we're on. And one other thing I wanted to share. This is from the Dhammapada. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The watched mind brings happiness. So thank you for allowing me to share my feelings and my thoughts at this very difficult and extraordinary time. And I'll turn it over now to, I guess, Jim, it's a Q&A. Is that what's next?
Yes. If there are questions or comments on anything of this today, or if things are going on, I mean, we're a small enough group here. If there are things going on in your practice or that you have questions about or would like to explore with any of the people here, I would encourage doing that too. We'll probably have a little bit shorter session today. We didn't know exactly how long people could tolerate sitting in front of a camera in, you know, without Zoom exhaustion, as that's the saying goes. So we'll go ahead and do this Q&A and finishing discussion, and then we'll let you go. And then Leslie will have next month with concentration, and I'll meet with my mentees at the end of the month to talk about this subject more. So are there any comments or questions about today, or anything else in your practice that you'd like to explore?
I just had a question. What was the N for rain?
The N in rain was for non-clinging, letting go. Mm-hmm.
And actually, if I could add, that acronym has been used by a number of teachers, and it's used in different ways, particularly the N. One teacher you may be familiar with, Tara Brach, has a new book out called Radical Compassion. And she uses rain as the basis for the book. It's recognize, allow, investigate, and in her case, nourish.
Oh, I like that.
So she brings the practice of self-compassion into the circle. And beautifully, synchronistically, a small Dharma Friends group I spend time with, we just started reading that book and the everyday practice of rain and bringing that nurturing of what we recognize and allow and have investigated to really bring insight to has been very powerful for people. It's certainly based on not identifying and not taking personally, but the nurturing adds a dimension that seems relevant now that I just wanted to mention.
Well, of course, I would just add that non-clinging, letting go, it is nourishing. Yes.
So I would like to really thank you, Susan. I found it a really helpful talk, and then that expands out to Jim and to Leslie and all of the comments. And I was also thinking about the RAIN acronym, and I didn't quite get the recognition and the acknowledging it. because those feel collapsed to me. If I recognize it, you know, how's that different from acknowledging it?
I think it can be something that was spoken of earlier. I think it might have been Joyce who spoke to this. We can recognize a difficult feeling and do everything we can to distract ourselves and push it away. Mm. And it's a little bit like Jim mentioning our kids. When they're being rowdy and we're all closed up at home, we may want to not allow what's going on. There may be some true limits that need to be established, but if we don't allow it enough to understand what's the need driving that, then it's hard to do what's skillful. So with difficult feelings, sometimes we recognize them and then we run around and do everything we can to push them away. And the practice of RAIN takes mindfulness into at least that momentary allowing and understanding more deeply before we can determine what is wise rather than reactive. So allowing might be the equivalent of just that moment to even label and open to, oh, I'm feeling really anxious. This is anxiousness. And then investigate. It's here in the center of my chest. It feels hot and pressured. If this anxiety were a voice, had a voice, what would that voice be saying? And then that informs, in Tara Brach's model, the nurturing and the nourishing, which is, of course, based on that non-identification and is furthered by recognizing and allowing and investigating. So I think allowing is very related, and they blend a lot in our experience, especially if we're practiced in mindfulness, they become even more intimately connected. But there is a slight distinction, which I recognize when I'm feeling something I don't want to feel. Mm-hmm. And I immediately start multitasking. Does that make any sense, dear?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? No? Okay, well, I appreciate everyone coming here today. I think it's been a very wonderful session for me. And, you know, I think it's good for all of our practice. Obviously, with the situation as Susan has identified it, there's a lot of people who are suffering. There's a lot of people who are under a lot of stress these days. So if there is merit from us coming today and practicing the Dharma and practicing for all people, then I wish to take that merit and offer it to all sentient beings so that they'll be at peace, so that they will be healthy, and that all of them will attain liberation. Thank you.
Stay well, everyone.
Yes.
This is the book, if anybody was interested in looking at it, Radical Compassion.
Okay, so we will see you either at the end of the month with your mentors or next month in May, probably online again, hopefully. It would be nice if it weren't, but I think there's probably no possibility this soon that anything else could be done. So we'll see you then.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.